Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Break the Cycle with me, your host, Joshua Smith. Sorry for the little lag there in the video. I didn't realize that my intro was over, and I was having a good conversation with our guest tonight. Guys, we got a great show for you tonight. Thank you for hanging out on Friday evening, going into the weekend with us and taking a couple days off the show. But let's start off with some sponsors. Of course, we have Lorenzotti.coffee for all your delicious Italian coffee needs delivered directly to your door. Bring the taste of Italy home. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. And of course, the man, the myth, the legend, my good friend Top Lobster, my partner on the show, TopLobster.com, for all your graphic design needs. Check him out today. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount, or join the Patreon, subscribe, star, or become a YouTube channel member to get into the private Discord server where we have great people like Stefan Kinsella and Angela McCardle, and you get new designs like the Thomas Swole design he released today, up to like 2 weeks early before the general population gets them at a 30% discount. So pretty good stuff in there. And of course, executive producers of the show, anthemplanning.com, for all your emergency and crisis planning needs. Check these people out today. See what they can do for your business, home, or personal life. They're doing a job the government sucks at much more efficiently and much cheaper. Guys, we have an awesome show to end the week with you today. I am very excited. This gentleman was a longtime advisor and chief of staff for Dr. Ron Paul and the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He is Mr. Jeff Deist. How you doing today, sir?
Hey, Josh. I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good, good. So typically, we were talking before the show started. I had Pear on like this week, Wednesday. He was episode 69, so there was a lot of nices in the chat. But I've had Zuby on. I've had Maj Ture. Oh God, Hotep Jesus, Dave Smith, Scott Horton twice. So it's been a really fun show. We've gotten a lot of really cool people on, and you know, I was able to leverage some of the contacts from traveling around for 4 years and meeting people. And but typically we start off the show talking about people's journey, but I think, like you said before this, enough people know about you, right? But I do know that some of my subscribers wanted to hear if you had a favorite story about working for Ron Paul before we get into anything crazy. What's your favorite story?
Oh, you know, Ron is just as he's what you see is what you get. No ego. So that's the number one thing. And I definitely remember going to a C-SPAN debate with him at the Daughters of the American Revolution Constitution Hall in D.C. So this would have been sometime in 2012. And so he's still a sitting congressman. And it was a Republican debate. So it was Mitt Romney and company. And I'm sure Mitt Romney had spent the 3 days leading up to the debate in some elaborate hotel suite, like perfecting certain lines and having his hair primped and getting some, you know, $8,000 Brioni suit a little bit better tailored. So meanwhile, like an hour before this thing starts, we're in Ron's condo in Northern Virginia, which is basically frozen in time, 1975. It's got like avocado green appliances and shag carpet. And Ron is puttering around making some Campbell's soup or something, totally unconcerned about this debate because he basically knows what he's going to say. And, you know, if he's speaking to a group of, you know, prisoners at Folsom, or, you know, 3 or 4 million normies watching a CNN debate, it doesn't really matter. And so, you know, that always stuck with me, that sort of lack of pretense, that genuineness. And for all of his, you know, and he'd be the first to tell you, he wasn't the greatest public speaker. But for all of his, you know, lack of concern over that sort of PR or image element of running for president, I think that was actually a strength for him, because people would hear what he had to say on stage, and it didn't sound scripted. It didn't sound political. And most of all, it wasn't boring. And so, you know, that sort of plain spokenness, I think, actually won him a lot of fans. It won him a lot more fans than it did votes. But, you know, I think that's something that he was really good. He was actually a lot more of a natural politician than people give him credit for.
Sure. Yeah, I think he was really relatable to a lot of people, which helped a lot. And that bold messaging is something that we should all be able to learn from. And in fact, we got a super chat from King Waffle. He said, healthy young man reads Ron Paul, gets pumped with massive dose of red pills, doesn't feel good, and changes. Many autism, many such cases. Exactly. I mean, that's why I'm here. That's why, you know, the majority of the people I know in this movement are here. So thank you for being an advisor and helping Ron along, for sure. But let's talk about COVID, because that's a pretty hot button issue for everybody. You know, we're on the precipice of this. You know, who knows what the federal government's going to do now. You know, there's crazy case spikes everywhere, and the Delta variant and this, and you got to take your vaccine. Well, now the vaccines aren't doing anything like they thought they would do. How screwed are we? I mean, economically, you know, after these stimulus bills and packing all the pork into saving their cronies, how screwed are we?
Yeah, it's pretty tough to shut down the world and then restart it, which is basically what they tried to do. And I would argue that, at least in part, they shut down the world to get Trump, which is pretty sick if you think about it. If Hillary Clinton had been president, I think the reaction to COVID would have been very different. And, of course, the media's reaction to what Hillary Clinton did would have been very different, would have been a very different story, very different narrative. But basically, we don't really know what money is anymore, because both on the fiscal and monetary side of things, the U.S. federal government went insane beginning in March 2020. So several trillion dollars in stimulus spending out of thin air by Congress, and about $9 trillion worth of new money and credit creation by the Fed on the monetary side. You know, this is basically the M1 money supply graph goes vertical in March of 2020. So we don't know what that means. It could mean nothing for a while, but it sure feels like there's nasty inflation spikes out there. And of course, some of this we can attribute to the shutdowns and the slowdowns from COVID, like lumber wasn't being processed, so lumber went way up, you know, that sort of thing. Car lots, they're not really making deals on cars because there's just not enough of them. But you know, I suspect that this new round of COVID that they're trying to press on us, which is basically maybe the Delta variant, I suspect it's far less lethal, which is why anecdotally we're hearing about a lot more people who are, you know, feeling flu-y and sicky and lethargic, but only for a couple days. It's a lot milder. I think over the past 16 months, most of us have been exposed to COVID already, whether we were symptomatic or not. You know, that's just the way of the world. And then now, you know, if there really is something called the Delta variant, that, you know, where people are getting sick again, but it's much milder. So are they going to shut down the world this fall? I think that depends on whether there's a political upside to it. If they insist on masks in school, or even worse, if they insist on sending kids home from school again and doing online, I think not only would you see an unbelievable explosion in homeschooling, but I think that would be bad for Biden. I think it'd be bad for the Democrats in the midterms. It's hard to say. The so-called Delta variant, a lot of doctors will tell you, if you look at this virus under a microscope, which they haven't really even isolated it properly, there's no way to tell between the original COVID, you know, little strands, and then the variant. I mean, there's no bright line between these things. They're kind of making this stuff up as we go along. And I hope, given the experience of the last 16 months, that Americans are skeptical and dubious and pushing back on this. But there's a weird subcurrent in this country right now. You know, you could almost call it retreatism, of these people who kind of liked shutting down the world. They kind of liked going home and having a great reset. They kind of liked being on their couch with their dogs or whatever all day, every day. They kind of like not having to be in that grind or that commute or that hustle and bustle. And you know, I think the economics of this are bad enough, Josh, but what I'm worried about is the long-term psychology of it. The herd mentality, the willingness to comply with authority, and then kids. Kids are the real, man, oh man, they're the real victims. This little toddlers and infants seeing adults in mass. I don't know what that's going to mean, but I mean, we've never had the world, not just, you know, one country, but the world shut down for that long. And so, of course, that's hugely deflationary. When people stop working, stop driving as much, stop going out to eat as much, stop buying as much, stop traveling as much, of course, all that's hugely deflationary. So, all that deflation is being countered by the Fed and Congress, who are doing everything they can to basically stick a cattle prod into the economy and cause inflation. So I don't know which one of those wins. If I knew, I'd be out there, you know, shorting whatever on E-Trade, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so unprecedented. And I think anybody who's making predictions right now is foolish, because I just don't know.
Sure. Yeah. I talked with Dave a little bit about when I had Dave on the show about the mental health of our children going forward and how long it's going to take for people to get over all of this. I mean, we have people who are just going to live the rest of their lives terrified, no matter what they do, whether COVID, even if COVID went away, they're going to spend at least the next decade just absolutely terrified to go outside, to be around people. It's really ruined our, you know, the growth of our children all over the country for sure. Let's see. I got another super chat if you want to talk about this. Jason Booth threw a $5 super chat. He said earlier this year on economics, liberty, inflation, you said economics is just a word for social cooperation. Can you expand on that? Is that something you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, that's how we deal with one another in the marketplace. As a matter of fact, Mises was going to title his book Human Action, Social Cooperation. In other words, what's the nexus by which strangers, which is most of us in a big developed modern society, most of us are strangers. So what's the nexus? What's the mechanism by which we all deal with each other peaceably? And the short answer is markets. But, you know, voluntary cooperation is just another word for markets. You can deal with someone else or not. But when we're yoked under government, then we're in effect dealing with one another violently, you know, not directly, but through our proxy, through voting. So those are the two basic choices. And for all the, you know, all this third way thinking and neoliberalism and all these sort of like, well, the world's changed and the Great Reset and now we have crypto and we have this and that. None of that changes the fundamental choice. You know, how do human beings deal with one another? They deal with each other by economic means, or they deal with one another by violent means, by state means. Those are the two basic choices for humanity. And there's no getting around those with fancy language or, you know, new theories or anything like that. You can't use MMT or, some sort of social democracy. Nothing escapes that. So, yeah, I think economics is dismissed even by a lot of libertarians. Like, well, that's just the financial or the money side of things. But there's also an element of individual or personal freedom that is not bound up with economics. I don't think that's really true. I think if you look at economics properly, it contemplates virtually everything, family, individuals, civic and social institutions, the marketplace itself. And then if you get into public choice and that sort of thing, it contemplates government as well and the perverse incentives which government creates. So, I look at economics holistically. I don't look at it as a narrow subset of human activity, but that, look, I'm biased. I mean, everybody, you go to anybody in any profession, I'm not an economist, but you know, if you go to surgeons, they're going to say you need surgery. If you go to physical therapists, they're going to say you need physical therapy. If you go to economists or people who love economics, they're going to say everything's economics. So that's where I am.
Sure, absolutely. So we talked a little bit before we started the show, but a while back, and you've been pretty vocal about this on social media and stuff about, you know, us kind of separating our movement from the term libertarian, and how that term's kind of been ruined. I know that there's been some pushback from some in the caucus, maybe in the Mises caucus, on that, you know, that narrative. But I mean, what do you mean by that, and why do you think that would be a good idea for us?
Well, I don't know that I think that. I mean, has the term been ruined? I'm kind of on the fence about that. And by ruined, I don't mean, intentionally or something. I just mean that language evolves and terms are either abused or misused sometimes into obsolescence. And so earlier this year, it was earlier this year in Pittsburgh, I was talking about this great George Orwell essay from, I believe, 46 called Politics in the English Language. You can find it online. It's really short. And, he talks about how politics shapes language and abuses it. And he comes up with this category of meaningless words. And he says, these are words which are used in consciously dishonest ways. And when I look at the morphology of the term libertarian over the years, I mean, now it's come to mean so many different things to so many different people. The question becomes, and I'm not saying that I personally have an answer, but the question becomes, is this term like liberal? Because liberal means a lot of things to a lot of people. It means a very different, Mises is liberalism and the liberal nationalism he lays out in that book or Nation, State, and Economy is a very different thing from, let's say, Robert Reich's liberalism or Bill de Blasio's liberalism, or even slightly different than Friedrich Hayek's or Ron Paul's. I mean, it means different things to different people. And at some point that a lot of people feel that term was co-opted by the left and that it almost became too late to reclaim it. And there was an attempt by using this term classical liberal. And that term gets thrown around a lot. But what people don't understand, David Gordon has written about this, classical liberalism is kind of a made-up 20th century term. Nobody used that before the 1900s. And so it was hearkening back to really a pre-war, an 1800s ideal of Enlightenment liberalism. And so, the very fact that the term had morphed is why, like Hayekians and sort of the George Mason, Reason, Cato crowd started saying, well, we're classical liberals. We're the real liberals. We're the classical kind. And the problem with that is that the left isn't buying it. You go tell a left progressive you're a classical liberal, and they'll laugh you out of the room. They don't care. They're not interested in these distinctions. Progressivism is not a buffet. You don't get to pick and choose the parts of it you like. It's a grinding, force in society. All right. So at some point, even a lot of libertarians would say, man, we sort of lost the term liberal. So could that ever happen to libertarian? I think it could. I mean, there a lot of people believe that to be a libertarian today is to accept a whole host of left cultural precepts, which I personally don't accept.
Sure.
And moreover, that to be a libertarian means that you accept progressive means, but you just want libertarian ends towards those means. And I don't accept progressive ends. That's not the kind of country I want or the kind of society I want to live in. So, is that term a hindrance today? I don't know. Maybe that's above my pay grade, but I'm not interested in being libertarian, this idea of being libertarian. Libertarian's an adjective. It's not a noun. Okay, there's a libertarian drug policy says drugs ought to be legal and decriminalized. That's a libertarian policy. When you say someone is a libertarian or I'm a libertarian or you're not a libertarian because you don't, then it becomes sort of like it's a lifestyle or it's a mode of living or it's a way of seeing the world or something. And I don't like that. I think having libertarian views ought to be as innocuous and as commonplace as if you went up and down your street and said, like, well, who's Catholic or who has red hair or something like that? It's ubiquitous, rather than this sort of clubbish thing where I'm interested in being libertarian. And you see this all the time. I saw this today on Twitter. When I say today, I'm speaking of Friday, whatever today's date is. But Dave Smith had apparently talked about immigration in some podcast, and he was being attacked for sort of not being taking a strong open borders position. And I don't know where Dave is personally on that. I'm against open borders. I think it's a crazy, bad idea. I think it is deeply illiberal. I think it's a big government project, which would never happen in a much freer or more liberal society. But nonetheless, a lot of people now have said, well, part of being a libertarian noun is to be for open borders. And if you're not for open borders, you're not a libertarian.
Right.
Well, okay. I'm not for open borders. So if that means semantically I'm not a libertarian, that's fine with me. I don't care. I'm interested in being right and correct, and I'm interested in human flourishing. And I disagree with Walter Block on some things, with this pure deontological approach. I think, when the consequences of something don't seem to jibe with the principle, I think you have to take another look at the principle. And so on immigration, for example, I believe that human beings have the natural right to leave a place. No one should ever be falsely imprisoned or enslaved, but that's different than the right to enter a place. And the fact that we have government property and government roads and government airports and ports, and the fact that we have public goods and vast swaths of public land, whether it's, municipal or county or state or federal, the fact that that's all muddied up by government, well, that's a complicating factor, okay? But so who owns and controls that, and how ought they own and control that, for whose benefit, or who should they allow or exclude? Okay, those questions are a little more complex, I think, than the open borders people want to admit. But my point here is not to litigate the borders question. And at the Mises Institute, we actually have far more diversity of viewpoint on borders than almost any place. Anywhere in Libertarianism, Inc., it's just like, you're for open borders, and that's it, or you're basically not getting hired.
Hi, kids. Do you like violence?
Are you sick to death of pussyfooting around the truth while being constantly fed lies by news and big tech tyrants? If so, then come join me, Dan Smotz, on The System Is Down, where we get weird, have fun, and dig into all the dangerous taboo topics like conspiracies, politics, religion, culture, current events, and everything your family just prays you don't bring up around the Thanksgiving dinner table. And I know that reality is scary to some people, so if you're easily offended, just ignore this and go back to making cat memes or whatever. But if you're ready to change the world for the better, come join me on The System Is Down at tsidpod.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's tsidpod.com, because the system is down and truth is taking over.
Certainly a Cato.
We have Walter Block, we have Ryan McMakin, we have, Hoppe, so, okay, fine. But if things have shifted, and this is a relatively recent phenomenon, treating immigration and open borders as a litmus test for whether one is libertarian, 20, 30 years ago, that it was kind of a much more minor issue. If that makes me not a libertarian, that's fine.
Yeah, and I've also, just in the decade or so that I've been involved in the movement, the broader movement, I've seen it pop up a lot more too. And I feel like it's such a wedge issue anyways, because as a libertarian, we have almost no power over what happens with immigration anyways, that it's silly to be arguing about it inside the broader movement. But yeah, that all that stuff really seemed to kind of permeate out of Cato, really. And there's a couple people I like at Cato. I'm not going to say everybody at Cato is horrible. I'm not a big fan of the Institute as a whole, but does it feel like they're trying to drive away the Mises types by using that issue?
Well, yes. I think a lot of the impulse behind the open borders people is Mises Institute bad. Yes, I do think that.
Sure. Yeah, I think that that's probably got something to do with it too. And I know Davis has talked a little bit about how, mass open immigration would be bad with the welfare state. And I know that that's something that a lot of, quote unquote libertarians agree with. That's the thing, is it's not a one size fits all issue, especially while.
Right, right.
While
but I mean, to me, it's also not a defining or, it's not an issue which animates me. If somebody's for open borders, I mean, that's fine. I'll talk about that. I'll even contemplate that. I wouldn't say, oh my gosh, I can never be involved with you politically, or I renounce you entirely because you're for open borders. I mean, I just don't see it that way at all. I mean, I think I think it's just something where it starts to affect the use of the term itself. And so when a term is used so broadly by so many people with really disparate worldviews, at some point, you have to say, has this become one of Orwell's meaningless words? Right? That's my point.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And it certainly seems like only one side is litigating what the proper role of libertarians on immigration is. So at least it's not coming from the Mises Institute, you know. We got a lot of super chats. If you want to answer some of these, Top Lobster, thanks, $5 super chat. He said, Ayn Rand Lexicon is a great book of what words used to mean. It's not a question. It was just this was a good one. Level Zero.
Yeah. Well, Ayn Rand Lexicon is alphabetical A to Z, by the way. Edited by Harvey Binswanger, who, believe it or not, is still alive.
Wow.
That guy must be in his 90s. And, of course, it starts with, in my opinion, a terrible little vignette on abortion, where she says an acorn is not a tree or something like that. But, you know, there's another thing. Let me say something about abortion. I actually looked up the plank in the national main Libertarian Party plank for abortion. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah,
well, there you go.
There you go. Cato is turning over right now. It basically doesn't take a stance on it.
Yeah.
Legislatively, and I think that's
says something like people of goodwill can disagree, and it ought to be localized or something like that. Yeah, that's about as good as you can do.
Yeah, there's good faith arguments on both sides of it, is what it says in the platform, which is, you know, I get it, but I also understand why some people don't want to join the party because of it. You know what I mean? I'm a pro-life guy personally. If I could hit the Murray Rothbard button, I would. So I guess I can't really be for legislating certain things. But, you know, is it murder or is it not murder? I mean, you know, that's kind of the moral question, at least. I don't really know where Ayn stood on that stuff, to be honest with you. I haven't read Lexicon, so.
She was very pro-choice. Very.
Oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense. Level Zero, $5 super chat. Thank you. He said, we've seen the great reset as described by the World Economic Forum being kickstarted. What would it really do to the world if enacted?
Well, we know what it would do. It would further intensify the gulf or the divide between the middle and lower classes and elites. I mean, that's what it would mean. It would mean more centralization. It would mean more supranational or international governance. It would mean that your ability as a local person to have a say over the laws which govern you would be even more attenuated than it is now by D.C. I mean, it's bad enough that we outsource so much to D.C. Now we'd be outsourcing it to Brussels or wherever. You know, I think it would be austerity for thee, but not for me. I think there would be private jets and Davos and... and I think the rest of us would be like, hey, you know, don't only turn your air conditioning down to 80 in the summer, you know, climate change, you know, that I think that's what it would look like. And of course, the developing nations, you know, huge, vast swaths of Africa and India and China, you know, which are just now rising up out of, you know, centuries of poverty and saying, hey, we're interested in how a society gets rich. You know, we want all that stuff. We want all the modern conveniences. We want automobiles. We want air conditioning. We want good internet. We want all that stuff. You know, right as these countries are sort of getting towards that tipping point, the great resetters want to say, well, you know, that all uses too much electricity. Well, there's climate change. The oceans are rising. Well, no. Not everybody can just fly around. And not everybody can eat meat because cows produce methane and this and that. You know, it sure strikes me as an exceedingly mean-spirited attack on the have-nots.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of what I've seen, too. It's just going to create less of a middle class. And we're all going to get poor together. Jeff, that's where we're headed. That's where they want us. It's right where they want us. Derek Slight, thanks for the $5 super chat, man. This is a good question-ish. One's compliment, $5 Canadian super chat. Thank you. Have you had any exposure to Curtis Yarvin? Do you know about Yarvin at all?
I know who he is. I find him just impenetrable and wordy. I don't read that.
Sure.
It's too much.
I was wondering if you were familiar with the neo-reactionary movement. This super chat was asking if you saw any value and engagement with the neo-reactionary circles, which, you know, Yarvin's the one who wrote about the cathedral and stuff like that, which we all talk about quite a bit now.
Well, I mean, I can't keep up with all the neos. I mean, Jesus, can't we just have old-fashioned reactionaries like me? I mean, and here's here's what people don't want to say is to be a libertarian is to be a reactionary against the 20th century, in effect. Income tax, central banking, Social Security insurance, Medicare, two world wars, police action in Korea, debacle in Vietnam, LBJ's Great Society entitlement programs. I mean, to be a libertarian is to be against all those progressive pushes, those incremental changes of the 20th century. So when libertarians want to say, oh my gosh, those right libertarians, those Mises Institute people are reactionary, it's like, well,
okay.
I'm against the things I just mentioned.
Sure.
That makes me reactionary, then so be it. But neo, that's I don't know what the hell that means.
They love that term neo, man. All neo means is new, right? So like Tom.
Well, I use neoliberal earlier, so I'm falling into meaningless words myself.
Sure, sure. Yeah, but it's funny because, you know, Tom's a neo-Confederate. We're neo-reactionaries. We're all neo-something. It's like, yeah, man, we're all new. We're all living in the 20th century together, you know? I don't know. Drywall, thanks for the $20 super chat, man. That's huge. Hey, this is a good one. John Chow, or John Howe. I always say Chow because his middle name is C, but he's a lawyer in New York, and he's asking about corporations if they're government entities. He says yes. How have you felt about the great censoring of people on the right? And do you think that, especially, you know, these big tech companies, do you think that we should have some kind of way to push back on all this censoring? Do you think that they are government entities?
Well, I think some of them are certainly close to it. I think they're mostly pretty slimy. But I don't want any regulatory apparatus at the federal or state level, because we know what that would be. First of all, it would be a debacle. Antitrust, monopoly, all that stuff. Just go back and read Rothbard, Man, Economy, and State. He's got, I think it's, I can't remember the chapter number on monopoly. That'll disabuse you of monopoly or antitrust. And if you wanted to create, you know, if a J.D. Vance or, one of these guys wanted to get into the Senate and create a regulatory apparatus for big tech, it would just end up being like the FDA or the FCC or something. There'd just be regulatory capture. And it would become a huge jobs program and a farce, and it wouldn't do what it was intended to do. It would end up doing the opposite and cost us a lot of money in the meantime. So I don't call for that, but I just like old fashioned common law tort. I think people ought to bring tort actions against some of these companies when under either equitable principles of contract or under tort theory when they get screwed over. You know, it's not a happy time, because it really isn't that easy with the network effects to build your own Facebook. But I think that'll come. I think that'll happen. So, as appealing, it sounds appealing to have, you know, government go after these slimy companies, but I don't think it would work.
Sure. Well, I know you didn't want to stay too long tonight, but we seem to be sort of out of super chats. But before we log off, I want to talk about Blood and Soil, Jeff.
Yeah,
it's something that has stuck with me. I've watched the talk that you gave, and I've even read the transcript, most of it, I think. It's something that's constantly held against anybody who says Mises publicly. You know, Jeff Deist, he said blood and soil, but can you expand on what you meant there? I mean, to me, I know, right? It was, you know, people in America still care about these things. And if we don't, as libertarians or as the liberty movement or whatever you want to call this broad movement, if we don't pay attention to that stuff, it's at our own peril. But is that, I mean, that was what you were saying, right?
Well, that talk was, that's a couple years ago now. First and foremost, that talk was about, hey, look, liberty comports with human nature. We don't need to transcend anything. We don't need to create some sort of Soviet new man to be compatible with liberty. What we have to do is just understand human nature and say that this idea that we're all hyper-individualistic is just nonsense. We exist in a network of family and friends and civic and social responsibilities. And so libertarianism ought to reflect that, and not to be this ideology of sort of wonkish people who are just like heads without bodies, who are just concerned with some life of ideas in the clouds and not concerned with day-to-day interests of people, especially the deplorables, whom libertarians love to hate. Notice the libertarian silence when a white Trump deplorable gets shot protesting by police in the Capitol. All of a sudden, that's A-okay. Oh my gosh, she was an insurrectionist. So that's an interesting tell there. But the idea of blood and soil was, it's an ancient concept used not only in Germany but in other contexts well before the Nazis. But the point there was that I disagree with the idea of civic nationalism, of the idea that America is just an idea, and that it doesn't. If you go read Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, America is not an idea. America is a very specific place. It has settled by specific people with specific self-interests, not always so peaceably on specific piece of property with specific identities at a particular time and place. It's not just this idea, because if it was an idea, you could just transport it anywhere. We wouldn't need open borders, right? You could have America in Singapore. You could have America in Venezuela. If America is just an idea, then nobody needs to move here. But it's not just an idea, it's a place. And so when some people say like, well, we should all be citizens of the world and this and that, okay, all right. Well, tell that to the Lakota Sioux Indians. Go tell them that they ought to let you in their tribe, even though you don't have any ancestry that's Lakota Sioux. You ought to be able to live amongst their tribe and work at the casino or whatever. Go tell the Irish that they shouldn't care about Ireland and its history with England. Now, that's all just water under the bridge. It doesn't matter. It's all just the UK now, or at least, not Northern Ireland, but Ireland's just part of the UK now. Tell the Poles, tell the Poles that they shouldn't care about Poland and Catholicism after what they went through in the 20th century, squeezed between Germany and the Soviets. When 6 million Poles died out of only like 30 million in the whole country, they shouldn't care about maintaining Polishness. And then, of course, the biggest example of this is go tell the Israelis and the Palestinians, you shouldn't care about this plot of land. Forget the Bible. Forget your historical claims. Forget your familial claims. That stuff's all nonsense. You should be more evolved than that. This is sort of, I guess, the caricature, and maybe I'm being unkind, the caricature of a DC libertarian worldview, that everything is universalist, everything applies everywhere, and if you just go explain property rights to, a Buddhist on a mountainside somewhere in a remote village of China, that he or she should just nod along, and that's not how the world works. So I was very much arguing for the idea that we should take people as they are and go from there. And so I used the term blood and soil descriptively, not prescriptively, because I don't think most Americans are mutts. I mean, most Americans Americans aren't very nationalistic. I mean, we are, what brings us together today is, I don't know, that's the problem.
Sure.
Cheap stuff from Walmart. Well, that's not enough. So that's the problem, is that we have had this sort of pie in the sky thinking. And so I very much object to the universalist creed. And while I do think that political liberty is the goal in the narrow sense of politics, I think beyond that, I think thin libertarianism is dead. I think we have to understand that culture and environment and relationships and civic society matter. So, I wouldn't change a word.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I listened to the speech. I thought it was a great speech. And, everybody just likes to use that moniker now. Nazi. Everything's a Nazi. Everything I hate's a Nazi. Any words you say I don't like is Nazism. So that's been something that we've dealt with for a long time since that speech, and I just figured you actually giving somebody the explanation on a show like this would shut somebody up.
I certainly didn't intend to create a situation which you would have to deal with. strikes me as bizarre.
It's just these it's, you know, when there's this very real fight for the soul of libertarianism in this country. And, you know, as you've said, you're fine with letting the term go. I think the Mises Caucus and people like me are like this one last stand to try and hold on to that word. And so, you know, we've had a lot of accusations lobbed at us of being, you know, whatever the hell they call us, reactionaries or white nationalists or Nazis or all this stuff. And they always pick, you know, pick and choose their little things to use against us. You know, Tom mm-hmm. Woods, you know, being for the Confederacy and you saying blood and soil and Hoppe saying physically remove. And it's like, it's always this like one phrase, you know, that they can just twist and twist and twist and twist any way they want. And that's something, you know, I think probably 90% of the people that talk about that have never listened to that talk or read the transcript from that talk, you know, and that's,
well, I'd be happy to send it to them.
I'm sure you would. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you coming on, man. Before we hop off the public stream here, can you tell people what you got coming up, where they can follow you, how they can support you in the Mises Institute?
Well, I hope people would consider following me on Twitter at Jeff Deist, all one word, JeffDeist. We got a busy fall coming up. I guess next week, yeah, I'm going to be in Orlando. YAL is having a thing down there, pretty big event, 2 or 3 day event in Orlando. So that's going to be fun. And we got some great books coming out this fall, and really, really looking forward to it. We got a lot cooking at the Mises Institute, and we've been very fortunate throughout COVID to be, you know, to own our own building and have a haven of sorts, a place where we can all come without the mania that's been around us. So compared to a lot of the country, we've been very fortunate.
Sure, absolutely. What can you give us a hint on some of the books coming out? I know Paris says he's got a book coming out November-ish, so that's pretty cool.
Well, we just released a new Hoppe book, which is transcripted from a series of lectures he gave, a whole week's worth of lectures he gave back in 2004. So that's really interesting, sort of big picture stuff, if you like Hoppe. We have new books coming out, compendiums by Ryan McMakin, who's one of our most prolific writers and a great writer, very underrated writer. More people ought to be reading him. New book by me. Which is also a compendium. We've got Per Bylund's great Austrian primer, which is just going to blow everything out of the water. It's going to be like half the length of Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. It's going to be literally like a pamphlet that you can put in your backpack or whatever when you get on a plane. It's going to be absolutely timeless and devastating. And then we've got a great Bob Murphy book coming out in December, which is going to explain all these, you know, all this crazy technical plumbing behind commercial banks and central banks. We all like to criticize the Fed, but when we do, we kind of need to know what we're talking about in terms of the mechanics of all that. And that's actually been a big knock on people of the Austrian view, which is, hey, you guys have great theories about interest rates and business cycles and yada yada, but, you know, out here in the real world, this is how commercial banks actually work, and this is how treasury debt is actually issued, and this is how the Fed actually interacts with the treasury and commercial banks and yada yada. And so Bob Murphy has written just an unbelievably great book that really simplifies and demystifies all that. So I think, you know, it's going to be like eating your Wheaties, you know, or going to the gym for leg day. You might kind of not want to, but you know it's going to be good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It Bob's great. I'm excited for that book, definitely. I got to keep adding, you know. I got to keep adding back here. But, Jeff, I appreciate you so much and everything that
sure.
you do for this movement. If you could just hold on for like 2 minutes, I'll end this stream with the people. And then if you're willing to do 10 more minutes for the exclusive,
sure.
guys, that'd
you
be
bet.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much. All right, guys, another awesome episode of Break the Cycle. Jeff is probably one of the most effective communicators of our principles and economics. I love the guy to death. Please go follow him on Twitter. He needs to have way more followers than I do on Twitter. I don't understand why you guys aren't following him. Do it. Shout out to John Howe for another super chat. I appreciate you, buddy. And Bubblegum Gun for the based and realist pilled Confederate Party super chat. Guys, go check out my sponsors, Lorenzotti.coffee, for all your delicious Italian coffee needs delivered directly to your door. Bring the taste of Italy home. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. Of course, toplobster.com, the man, the myth, the legend. Please go give this man your money. He works. Basically, I have him chained up in the basement just drawing all the time. So go buy stuff from this guy so he can afford to buy his way out. Use BTC at checkout for a 10% discount. And of course, anthemplanning.com, executive producer of the show, for all your emergency and crisis planning needs. Check them out today. See what they can do for your business, home, or personal life. They're doing a job that the government sucks at much more cheap and much more efficiently. That's what I meant to say. Drywall O, thanks for the $5 super chat. He said, y'all better join Mises Caucus or I'll beat you to death. Coming up on the show next week, we got so many amazing guests. I hope you guys will stick around after the weekend. I will see you on Monday for the show with the founder of the Redacted Caucus. It's going to be a lot of fun. Sign up right now to watch the live exclusive chat right after this ends with Mr. Jeff Dice. It's going to be a good one. I will see you on Monday, but until then, don't forget to break the cycle.
Due to legal reasons, I just have to explain. The lyrics of my last song may seem to contain a violent call to action in the verse and refrain. But I just meant it in Minecraft. The helicopter part was in reference to GTA 5 and the things you do. So any violence you commit, I am not an excuse, because I just meant it in Minecraft. A chipper is my friend and he's constantly cold. Accusations of incitement getting totally old. Make your own choices, yeah, you have control. Because I just meant it in Minecraft. Obviously I would never advocate force, unless it's due process and a trial of course. And if you're convicted we will make you a corpse. In Minecraft, just in Minecraft. You're nothing, I mean, you know it. No product dinners, getting close to COVID.